Welcome to this week's podcast of Kicking It with Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. Hey, Cindy, take it away.
And hello out there. In our previous episode, we talked about the final four, the four treatment options resulting from stage 5 kidney failure, which is commonly referred to as end-stage renal disease. We also discussed the pros, the cons, and the costs associated with the treatment options available. Now, in this week's episode, we will talk about how the diagnosis of chronic kidney disease can affect patients and their families. We will also discuss some of the methods clinicians and providers use to help patients transition, and we will tap into the social and financial resources that are available to support dialysis communities. So, BJ, what is the word on the street?
Right, Cindy. Well, each week we ask people on the street to share with us their experience with dialysis. So let's listen to what they have to say this week.
Word on the street with Simone.
Hey, Simone. We are here today talking to dialysis patients, and we asked them, how are you mentally coping with the diagnosis of chronic kidney disease and going to dialysis 3 times a week? And are there any financial challenges that have increased your stress level? Here's what they said.
I'm not coping. It's very difficult because I didn't expect to be here, and I don't like it. Because of being on dialysis, I have to figure out other ways of working, and I have to figure out ways of making money. And so there's different avenues that I have to take for making money than just the basic 9-to-5. And so the stress level is up because I realize that the people I have around me don't know what I need to know, don't know what they need to know to help me out with this situation, because everybody works and I can't work anymore. So I have to find another way of making money. So yes, it has definitely added stress.
Well, as far as coping with it, I really, it's kind of hard because it's a lifestyle change. You really can't do anything because when you go 3 times a week, it pretty much, you're pretty much done that entire day, because by the time you get home, your energy level is so low and everything, you don't want to do anything. You just kind of want to rest. So 3 days, well, really more than 3, because the following day, it just kind of depends on, your body. So really every day is, not that you're on dialysis every day, but every day it takes something out of you physically and mentally, because you can't do for yourself sometimes. You have to depend on other people. And being independent, it's hard to ask someone to do something for you. So I'm coping with it the best way I can. However, it's hard. It's just really hard to do this, and knowing if I don't get a kidney, this is something that I have to do the rest of my life, depending on the machine to make sure that I stay alive. It's hard to deal with. It's very hard, but I'm blessed to be alive, so I can't really complain about that, because I know some people, didn't even have the opportunity to have dialysis. Mm-hmm. So I am thankful in a way, but at the same time, it's hard. It's very hard. So I don't want to be a burden on my family, but I know that, eventually if I don't, get a kidney, then I may be. So that's probably what bothers me the most. Finances is always a burden, because it's always something you're worried about, because with dialysis and having to go 3 times a week, I can't drive myself. So if I don't get transportation, I have to depend on other people to help me with those things. So, you don't want to just, have somebody come out and help you. And I know there's Uber and all of that, but that's still a waiting game. And when you finish with dialysis, you want to leave immediately. And I know there's home dialysis, and that's an option, but that's kind of private. So if your insurance doesn't pay for that, which mine doesn't, then I would, I have to go to where my insurance is covered. Mm-hmm. So it may not always be the best place to go, but you know, it's a place where my insurance covers me, so I have to go there. I have to make sure that I eat right, so I have to buy fresh food and, you know, food that's good for me. So, in a sense, yeah, that becomes a, you know, a financial burden because you have to make sure that you have enough money to cover the good food. So you want to make sure that you, you know, put good things in your body so you don't mess up your dialysis treatment.
All right, then, BJ, your thoughts?
Well, we thank our people on the street for their candid answers. Mm-hmm. What we hear is that it can be an emotional toll coping with being on dialysis. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a financial burden. Mm. But it's doable. There are thousands of people that are doing it every day. But what we constantly heard our respondents say is it's hard. It's mm-hmm. not a walk in the park.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Maria and Marion, by the way, you guys, Marion had taken a sabbatical. She went on vacation, okay, in the midst of COVID. She said she had her shots, okay? She went on vacation for 2 weeks, but we're glad to have her back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
Are you really, Marion? Are you really?
I am.
Okay. So this question is for Marion and Maria. What are the immediate lifestyle changes that you've seen with newly diagnosed patients, you know, and the medical consequences when they are not compliant? You know, we talked about compliance.
Okay. Well, basically, with this disease process, it's going to find a way in your life, whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. It's a disease process that's here. You have to manage and deal with it. Just as our people on the street said, it affects you mentally. It affects you financially. Mm-hmm. And physically, I don't know if I said that, but all of those things. So you've got to be able to make this a part of your life. It's just as a child, just as a husband, you're mm-hmm. on dialysis. So you have to, you know, fit this in. Mm-hmm. And there are some changes when you start dialysis as far as medications, as far as, you know, financial, more money, you know, with certain things with the medications, depends on what your insurance covers or not. And your diet, what you're eating. Like they said on the street, you've got to change what you eat because you're on dialysis to live and you have to make it manageable. So you have to incorporate some things in your lifestyle.
You know, Marion, we're talking about the grieving process. There are stages.
Yeah.
How do you, when you, those patients come in and they're newly diagnosed, do they go through those processes?
Absolutely. And this one hits home for me personally. I know
yes.
that my mother was a dialysis patient.
Yes.
And so this one just resonates personally for me. I, as a clinician, wanted, of course, her to move through the various stages right. very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. you got this diagnosis. Okay, you should be happy that we have treatment options available. You should be happy about that.
That's what you felt.
That's right. what I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did not understand that she needed her own time to process right. and she needed time to move at her pace.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a clinician, that taught me something. When a new patient comes in, I purposefully make a point of helping them to understand that we recognize that this is something that's going to take time
right.
for them to process. And I encourage them to do just that. You take your time. Another thing that I have done that I have found to be helpful is I share that same approach with the family members, the caregivers right. too, so that they're not pressuring the patient to move through this process. Because it absolutely, there is a point of grieving that takes place. So,
was your mom still working? Was she before she had to?
She actually, She had retired as a nurse.
Yeah, and your mom was a nurse.
That's correct.
Yeah,
she had retired from her nursing career.
Mm-hmm.
And but she was still busy doing other things
mm-hmm.
in the community, in the church, and, you know, with the family. So she was still very active.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we needed to make this transition, it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. I did not recognize that she actually was experiencing depression. I didn't recognize that for what it was. I learned some things.
Was it because you were too busy with your lifestyle?
I believe so.
Okay.
And I wanted
you had to work, you had kids, have a husband.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I learned some things. I learned the importance of just being patient. When I did take a step back and look at it, I said, you know, you really have to treat this like any other life-altering diagnosis, because that's exactly what it is.
Yes.
And you wouldn't tell someone who is receiving cancer treatment, well, just get over it. Come on, let's move on.
Right.
The same understanding and same respect has to be there for someone who's been newly diagnosed with renal failure.
Other disease processes that are life-threatening, like you were talking about with cancer, they don't have a team around those population of patients. Dialysis patients have a team around them, you know, acknowledging the fact that is it a life-altering process. So you have that interdisciplinary team for dietitian, social services, social worker, and you have your nurse. So I think that is that's one of the good things about this disease process is that there is avenues to reach out to.
And we kind of work, like you say, as a team, mind, body, and soul. So it encompasses all of those three things.
So Rita, what are some of the essential tools that you guys use as social workers to determine and to help the newly diagnosed patients?
Okay.
And what are some of the common problems that you see with these patients adjusting to their disease process?
Okay. One of the things we do is formally called a psychosocial assessment. I call it, I sit down and talk to you.
All right.
Because I want to know about you. It is a comprehensive evaluation about the patient's physical, mental, emotional health, along with their abilities and ability to function in the community. It's a roadmap of your life. What I want to know, and what we hopefully I will be able to get my patient to share, is a little bit about themselves, who they are, where they come from, where they want to go. You know, I want to see warts and all. That's what I want to know, because it encompasses all of that for us as a team to work together to be able to work and come up with a plan for that patient. So I may ask things about their mental health. I may ask about surgeries. I may ask about allergies, abuse. Are you employed? Do you have a wife? Or, you know, all those kind of things. It's a intense conversation, but it is a conversation. You want the patient to be able to tell you as much as they can about you, because you want to learn as much as you can about them. So you're able to meet the patient where they're at. Because your plan is not like anyone else's plan. Your plan is individualized. So we definitely want to do that. Some of the reoccurring themes that I do see is, like the people on the street said, financial difficulties, transportation. How am I going to get there, Rita? Who's going to take me? You know, I'm going to be going in and out of hospital. I've already been in the hospital three times since I've been diagnosed. You know, restrictions are my leisure. I just can't come and go anymore. You know, I have this machine that I have to go to. You know, the fear of the disability itself. Even death. And even depending on that machine. What does the future have for me, Rita? What is that? It is having to deal with a lot of stages where they may go through denial. They may be angry. They may, you know, bargain with God, bargain with whoever they believe in. And depression, a lot of depression. And at one point they accept. But these stages are interchangeable. So one day I may be angry as angry can be, and the next day I'm going like, well, you know, this is my lot in life.
Oh my gosh. So BJ, dealing with people, I know you know a lot about people working in sociology, especially the Native Americans. What are some of the barriers that you've seen with minorities as far as adjusting to changes, lifestyle changes, when they've had any type of illness or diagnosis?
Well, I like how our team called it a life-altering disease. Anytime you're diagnosed with a life-altering disease, part of your identity changes. The things that, you know, you never had to think about before, now that becomes a priority. And so it's not uncommon that that's going to be associated with feelings that we mentioned here, such as grief, right, and their sadness, fear, anger, frustration, even jealousy. You know, people that don't have an illness.
When you say jealousy, what do you mean by jealousy?
Jealousy, you know, that I'm ill and you're not.
Ugh.
So I see my family, particularly if we're talking about families and the people that are close to us, who often affect how we feel about ourselves.
Right.
So my family can get to go places, they can do things, they're still enjoying their life, they're still doing their everyday things, whether that's going to work or going to parties or, you know, just enjoying their social aspect. And I can't do this anymore because... I'm locked down 3 days a week. I'm missing out on a lot of things, that a lot of social interaction. So one of the things that we know that can be very helpful in people, especially when they're newly diagnosed, is to address the feelings that are associated with it. And the first thing is try to recognize feelings and helping people recognize what that is, because they bury it oftentimes. They're like, I'm fine, I'm, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. But trying to help them identify what those feelings are, an exercise that we used to tell people to do is simply say to yourself, this makes me feel like, and then fill in the blank. And once you have identified what that feeling is, whether I'm angry, I'm frustrated, I'm depressed, then you can share those feelings with your family members. I loved what Maria said.
What if you don't have a support? What if you don't have that support at home?
Well, that's when you don't have that support. There are other options that doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but there are support groups.
Well, they
do
have. I would say really, they do have a support system because we have a built-in support system.
Oh, what Maria was talking about.
Yeah, we have the nurses, we have the dietitian, we have, you know, the social workers. We are their built-in support because sometimes it is true, there are some patients that have no support system, but we're here for them. We're here for them. I know as a social worker, I do my rounds on the unit and I talk to the patient, and if it takes me time to sit down and have a conversation, 40, 45 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is, I sit down and give them that attention. So they do have support. May not be, like you say, at home, but they do have someone they can talk to.
Now, I've had some patients, even though as, you know, clinicians, we view our interdisciplinary team as a good thing. And we want the patient to know that, you know, we're here, we support you, we're available to you. A patient gave me a different perspective on that. And what she shared is that though she appreciates our efforts, she did view them as somewhat intrusive, invasive. And as I began to ponder more about what she was sharing, I understood her position. She said, for example, I have to tell you all what I eat, when I eat, how much of it. I have to come and I have to tell you all why I decided not to come the other day, and listen to you give me information again about how I'm harming myself again.
So accountability at this stage of the game is just too much for her?
Well, what she was sharing is that sometimes what we view to be a good thing can be overwhelming.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, it could be, Miriam, like you say, they may see it that way and view it that way, but it's also our approach to our patients. I mean, if we are not seeing our patients as individuals, then the patient, and if we don't establish that rapport with our patients, I mean, because like you say, I've been doing this for a long time, and patients will say, Rita, if you said you were going to call me or you were going to do A, B, and C for me and you didn't follow through, then I don't blame them for not trusting me. It's that, I think, that trust that you build with your patients as a clinician. I think if we say we're going to do something, we need to do it. And like you say, I understand the patients will say that, but I think they need to understand that we are really there for them. We want the best for them. I mean, we can read their labs. We know what they've been needing and what they haven't.
Well, BJ, one of the things that I was thinking about is that we have different cultures.
Right.
Native American. Mm-hmm.
Hispanics,
American Americans, African Americans, all kind of Americans. Okay. How do we, because at the units, we don't oftentimes have individuals that's on that team.
Right.
Okay, BJ, that can deal with these mores, where they came from. You see what I'm saying? How do we handle that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know you're looking at the different cultural aspects.
Yes.
In terms of communicating with people with this particular condition. I think that's two separate things. One of the things that I'm going to always advocate for, because I've seen it works, is having that that support group that comes from the group.
Okay.
Particularly talking support groups, and like I said, they have them online. I don't know in your area what they have, but it's certainly something to think about. They're very easy to start. Mm-hmm. But when people are talking to other people who are in like situations, right. they mm-hmm. speak the same language. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They understand the same concerns. Mm-hmm. You heard from our person on the street who says, you know, other people who are around me don't understand. They don't understand what I need or what I have to go through. And so I think sometimes having those kinds of interactions within those groups, people, one, find out about resources they didn't know existed. Two, they find out that they're not alone. So that can help alleviate some feelings of depression and isolation.
Yeah.
Because they're not different.
They're
not different.
Okay, Sarita. We're back to you again in this money. All right. Can you tell me what the average American, well, let's say, start with the minorities. They're now been diagnosed with this disease. Probably going to lose their jobs. Hmm. How is that going to, what type of impact is that going to have on a family?
Well, a whole lot. But I first have to reach out to Miss Marion, who went on vacation without me. So
let me go again.
I didn't get my COVID update for 2 weeks. I need to know whether you were tested once you got
double
back.
Double vaccinated.
I didn't even get a t-shirt.
I'm going back in a couple weeks.
You gonna hook me up then? Okay.
You.
Well, I have a list waiting on
you. Got you.
Now, your question again was the impacts financially.
Yeah. And how much income? What are these? I mean, the average American or African Americans, what are they making these days?
Well, according to the 2018 Census Bureau, now, you know, we have some new numbers coming out real soon because we just completed a census. But I got some questions about that census, but we'll save that for another show.
Okay.
The Asian Americans increased by 10.6%. Mm-hmm. So that's about 88,774 to 98,174. Mm-hmm. Your Hispanic community increased from 32,382 to 56,113. Mm-hmm. And again, my people, which, by the way, Marion, I was going to tell you that story you told about the lady.
Yeah.
Where I'm from, that's called you all up in my business.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, that was a nice way of her saying that.
That's
absolutely
right. But getting back to the numbers, the African Americans are at $42,447. That's where they were, and they've gone to $46,073. Mm-hmm. So, as always, we're still at the bottom of the food chain.
I want to be with the Asians.
But I brought good news today.
Okay.
Usually I'm beating up on people.
All right.
I'm going to step over in Miss Rita's territory for just a minute.
And we're going to let you. We are going to let you.
I appreciate that, Miss Rita. I'm just taking over. Okay. I just wanted to offer the listeners six possible resources. Your first resource is always going to be your social worker in the unit. Mm-hmm. And in most of those cases, they're going to be able to help you with local and national nonprofit organizations, resources such as American Kidney Fund and places of that nature. maybe even discounts on pharmaceuticals.
Definitely.
As well, mm-hmm. and help you get some ongoing financial support. One thing, and I don't know, Ms. Rita, you may be able to speak to this, but what I found was that if you were on dialysis, you can get discounts on household expenses.
Some, it just depends. I know that American Kidney Fund will help with some things like
right.
that.
Now, we're not talking food stamps here.
Okay.
You know, that's a separate story. We're talking electricity, water, and heating. And
it depends on each state. Each state mm-hmm, will vary, mm-hmm. and depending on what kind of stuff they have out there. Some states, they help with people that are on disability. They may give them a discount.
Right. And that's exactly what my research showed, was that if you talk to your providers they and explain your situation, they may be able to offer a discount. Now, the next one, we're going into a more technical area. We're going to talk about a new trend called crowdfunding.
Crowdfunding?
Crowdfunding.
That would mean us. Crowdfunding.
Yeah. It's like when people go online and they set up their page and they explain their situation.
Really?
GoFundMe.
Like a GoFundMe.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And they set up their experience, what they're having issues with, and they ask their friends and community people to donate.
Nice.
And so then they have a pool of money that's readily accessible when they need it, that's not necessarily governed mm-hmm. by other people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So these are things that we want to get people to think about. Now, last week, Ms. Barclay, you asked me, what did credit have to do with anything?
Sarita, why you go ahead. Go ahead. You
said, how did we get the credit?
Okay. How so we Rita said we. What did you say? We have credit.
We have credit. It may not be the best credit, but we got credit.
Okay.
Well, we got another problem today.
Okay.
It's credit and banking. Uh-huh. So what I have found is those who have credit that are on dialysis and have expenses, maybe it's their copay or something like that, in many cases, they're actually using their credit card to pay the bill. So at some point, the slippery slope, the bill comes due.
That's right.
So what is actually being discussed, again, similar to the utility companies, if you go to your bank, now that's a problem because a lot of times we have banks that are in the grocery store, but we don't have bankers.
That's why we didn't get those PPE loans, remember? A lot of independent contractors didn't get those PPE loans.
So we need to be talking to the banks and our bankers about what our situation is, because they have options.
Hold on. If I don't have no credit, what am I talking to my banker about?
But you got a bank account.
So, but most, okay. But I'm going to need that.
I welcome the challenge because, see, part of the thing is when we talk about educating and this being an educational forum, we have to also educate people about forming a relationship with their bankers.
I agree, but a lot of banks make a lot of money off of those overdrafts.
They absolutely do, particularly the ones in the grocery store.
Yeah. So are these type clients still as valuable as the ones who are not, you know, the ones that are not in the red?
No, but what we can do is, because we know that you can repair credit, improve credit. And so what we have to do is educate them on how to fix it.
Okay, Sarita, hell, I'm sick. I'm on dialysis. I'm sick. Okay. I got to worry about my medications, my family, may not have a job, have to apply for disability and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying, and I understand that you're always financially sound. Mm-hmm. But come on, Sarita, tell me something different.
Okay.
The song say, tell me something good.
Well, this is what I would tell you.
This is good.
This is true. Okay. This is what I would tell you. You can pull your credit report for free.
Okay.
If you have time to watch Young and the Restless, you have time. You have time to actually take one issue on your credit report, address it, and put it in the mail. You're on the dialysis machine for 3 hours. Mm. You mean to tell me you can't sit there and look at your credit report and do a little something, something?
No, because I'm going to sleep after my nurse gets me on. Mary, what am I going to do? Maria, what am I going to do after the nurse gets me on? What am I going to do?
Go to sleep.
Okay. So are y'all saying that I should follow Sarita's suggestion?
Well, I think what Ms. Sarita is saying is that if I have a special need, then I need to put forth a special effort to address my need.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Amen. Come on now, preach.
Okay, so BJ,
I want to ask a question. I'm listening. I want to ask a question. So if a person is recently diagnosed, and from what our previous segment said, you get your diagnosis and then you're referred to the center. Mm-hmm. How long will it be? And I know it's different for everyone, but what's the average amount of time between the time that I'm on dialysis to the point that it starts to affect my employment if I work a 5-day week?
Almost immediately.
That's very situational, though. Yeah. It depends on the availability of your clinic. There are some clinics that understand that patients are still trying to work and have late shifts. And then there's some clinic. Most clinics do not, though, unfortunately, offer that late shift time.
It's a business, right, Sarita? It's a business.
Are dialysis business open 24 hours?
No, they are not.
Only the nocturnal.
Which are units. a handful for the population of patients that you have.
And that's not even all 24/7. Don't they stop at 4 o'clock in the morning? It's really not. Nocturnal is really not all night.
Right. Well, those units that do nocturnal probably still do the regular day shifts and the evening shifts.
Okay. So the patient would have to do some education if they did need to work a late shift or something like that. But there is options.
There are options. And even with the nocturnal, you're away from your family.
Yeah.
At night. You're sleeping at a unit in a chair.
Oh, so you're not at home.
You're not at home with nocturnal dialysis.
So you're still in the dialysis unit. Correct. Yes. So that's why training is so important with all of these units. Yeah. Training is extremely important. I cannot emphasize. Go ahead, BJ.
For our person who on the street said, I don't drive, that person was meaning they don't drive because they don't drive. But you can drive after you have dialysis, right?
Yeah, I'm going to let one of the nurses answer that because I think there are side effects to the dialysis. If Maria and Marin can touch on that for us, please.
And I think that's a very individual thing because a couple of variables to be considered would be the fluid management for that patient. Oftentimes, those that do experience or share that they have some, that they're not feeling well towards the end of or at the end of their treatment, is usually related to fluid. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, with making an adjustment with the amount of fluid that is removed, the ultrafiltration, oftentimes that corrects the problem. I tell patients, you should leave here and you should feel fine. You should be able to carry on with your activities for the day. If not, if you came in and you were feeling fine and you're not feeling that way when you leave, communicate that to us because that gives us an opportunity to look at what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Because you should feel fine. You know, if you had events planned for the evening, you should still be able to attend and carry on.
Ms. Marion.
Yes.
When I go by the dialysis facilities, I see a lot of ambulances.
Yeah.
So who's in the ambulance if a lot of people are driving?
Transportation. Yeah, they use that as a means of transporting back and forth to dialysis. So there are some patients that, because of their health conditions, they have to.
They require.
That's a beautiful word. Thank you.
Require that type of transportation. Yes. You'll see wheelchair vans. You'll see Ubers pull up. You'll see the full-blown ambulance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But again, it's all with compliance. And we have to really enforce as healthcare providers that even though you've been diagnosed stage 5, ESRD, time for dialysis. Mm-hmm. You dialyze to live. You do not live to dialyze.
Love it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so BJ's been working on Facebook, and we have a few questions, for you guys to answer. Okay, the first question comes from Norma. She wants to know, what questions should I be asking my kidney doctor?
Number one would be options. Mm-hmm. What works best for you? That's the biggest thing. How much time do you have? Options as far as, I'm at this stage of renal failure. Mm-hmm. I'm getting ready to start dialysis. How much time do I have? Which stage am I at? And what options do I have when I get there so that I can plan ahead according to what my lifestyle is? Choosing dialysis, unfortunately, but choosing dialysis on your terms.
Nice.
Okay. The second question, and anybody just jump right in. Joanne asks, what is the criteria for donor compatibility and who pays the medical bills for the donor.
Mm-hmm.
Rita.
For that, who pays the bills?
First of all, what's the difference between a recipient and a donor? You know, when you're talking about transplantation.
The recipient is who's receiving the kidney.
So if I'm the patient.
Right, you're the patient, you will be the recipient.
Okay.
If I'm the donor, I'm the person giving you.
Giving me that gift of life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you and I have to be compatible, so all our lines have to match up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Who pays for it? The person's insurance, the patient's insurance.
So is Medicare going to pay for a for a donor?
Yes.
Medicare will pay for the donor for the recipient.
For the harvesting and all that, Medicare or your insurance or both pay for it.
Okay, well, that's a good thing to know. All right.
Can I add one thing to that? There is something called the swap.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about making sure all your lines are in order for your donor. Mm-hmm. But say I'm a patient, I have a donor.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend that's a patient, they have a donor.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not compatible with our friends, but I'm compatible with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
So you get worked up for transplant, and then you set a date, and then you do a swap.
Okay, well, Maria, if I were the person looking at this objectively, if I've got a 25-year-old person, okay, and you're offering me your 75-year-old grandmama,
who may be very healthy,
whatever, Mary.
Well, I don't know if 75-year-old grandma is giving a kidney.
Okay, okay.
Because you're still worked up regardless.
So is the swap equitable? I mean, is it?
It is, absolutely. Okay. When they're going to do a transplant, they make sure you're able to receive the kidney, healthy enough to receive it, and the donor is healthy enough to give.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Our third question is, how long does it take to get a kidney transplant?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've established in our last episodes, Marion, when you were cruising around the world, we established that basically it's cheaper to get a transplant than to be on dialysis.
Yes. Yeah.
So this person wants to know, Maggie, I'm sorry, wants to know, how long does it take to get a kidney transplant?
Well, if I'm stage four, I can talk to my doctor and ask for a workup already. And if I'm able to get a kidney and you're able to give me one, I can do it then.
Yeah.
So I don't have to be on dialysis yet. Remember? Okay.
Or if you're on dialysis and you've been on dialysis, for quite some time, they look back at the first date of dialysis, number one now. So you get credit. Your clock starts ticking as soon as you start dialysis. Right.
So average is like 3 to 5 years?
Well, it's between 5 and 6 now. That's the latest that I've heard.
Okay.
And I think that's because, Marion, we won't give away our body parts. We don't want to give away kidneys, you know?
And we've been talking about that, helping our minorities understand that. We talked about it last week. You know, that is something we continuously need to educate our population.
Donor alert, just so you're aware that whenever you give, especially a kidney.
Right.
You are listed or given high priority if you were to go into renal failure yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So don't think that you're missing out on a piece of life by giving a piece of you to someone else who needs part of life. There are options for you as the donor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And our last question is from Betty. Betty wants to know, why do you need a partner for home dialysis? Are there healthcare professionals such as home healthcare nurses or people that can train you and support you?
Mm-hmm.
What was that, Marion?
I said to Miss Betty, for your safety, Miss Betty, you do want to have someone available in that home setting for those unexpected emergencies that will likely come about.
Okay.
So, Miss Betty, if you have a drop in blood pressure and you lose consciousness, you need someone to be available to recognize that and initiate the actions necessary.
So couldn't any nurse do that, Mary?
You need a trained professional in dialysis.
Okay. All right. All righty. Well, we're going to wrap this up, and we're going to get our thoughts from our panelists. Rita, we're going to save you for last because we want you to give the final thought.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, Miss Marion. Well, tell us something.
I think today's topic is one that has opened up an opportunity to have some more discussion. Newly diagnosed patients need to know that they will experience a range of emotions. Right. They need to know what resources are available to them. So I think today's topic, we just scratched on the tip of the iceberg.
Okay. Maria.
For a dialysis patient, this now has to become your new normal. Mm. So you have to make changes and accommodations mm-hmm. if you care to live. Because again, not dialyzing at all is also an option. But you have to make accommodations, as I said, to live. So you need to, again, utilize resources. And for dialysis patients, you have that team. So utilize them.
BJ, make us feel better. Make us feel better.
The reality is you're not alone. You know, no matter how it may feel, you are not alone. Mm. You have a team. You have, if nothing else, you've got you.
Yeah.
You got yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of that is knowing that when this is all said and done, there are still things that are worth living for.
Yeah. All right. Oh, I love it. Sarita, I need a final thought from you, and that's all I need is the final thought.
Talk money, Miss Sarita. Talk money.
Well, actually, I'm going to take a different approach because we're talking to newly diagnosed patients here. Mm-hmm. So I want to be encouraging.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Amen.
And also, because we didn't get to all six of my points, of which one of them was talking to your employer about their options. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they may even be willing to do some fundraising for them. Mm. But my final thought is...
Well, I have to say something on that. Do you think as an employer that most of them care anymore? They're watching their budgets. They're watching the bottom line, which is the productivity and the money.
Insurance premiums go up as a dialysis patient.
Well, but I think since the heart of America is a small business, mm-hmm. I think you have to look at it differently. And maybe in corporate America,
yes,
they probably may not offer you that. Mm-hmm. But when you've been around a mom and pop organization yes. for X number of years,
yes.
there's a tends to be a different feeling and a different way that mm-hmm. we look at things mm-hmm. when we deal
commitment
with
commitment and loyalty.
Right. Yes. So that would be my answer to your question. But you see, you've taken away from my time, so I can't use my final thought as I planned it. So I'm going to have to do a little damage to Robert Frost here.
Okay.
Robert Frost said, and I'm paraphrasing because you took my time, two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I couldn't travel them both. I chose the road less traveled by, and that's made all the difference. And so for new patients, I need you to choose the road that's going to live or offer you longevity mm-hmm. in your life mm-hmm. and success in your dialysis.
Oh, I need an amen on that from everybody.
Amen.
Oh, let me hit that clap.
Hit that clap. Here you go.
Well, John Chip said, you either get bitter or you get better.
Yeah.
It's that simple. You either take what has been dealt to you mm-hmm. and allow it to make you a better person, or you allow it to tear you down. Mm. The choice does not belong to fate. It belongs to you. Mm. What will you choose?
So we have to choose the right things.
That's right.
Thank you guys so much. And next week, we're going to be talking about body image. You know, I need to lose a few pounds myself, but it's a little deeper than that. But join us next week on Kicking It With Kidneys.
Be sure to catch us on social media on our website, kickingitwithkidneys.com, also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube.
Our topic next week is going to be about body image. We hope you have enjoyed the show, and we look forward to you joining us next week on Kicking It With Kidneys.
Oh, I love that.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Kicking It With Kidneys with your host, Cindy Barclay. See you next week. The views expressed on this podcast are educational and opinion-based. These are not medical doctors.